Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by. Welcome to the YPO-WPO Peace Action Network, GCC, Iran Today, Demystifying the Islamic Republic. During today's presentation, all lines will be in a listen-only mode. Following the presentation, we will be opening all lines for an open discussion. During that time, if you are not speaking, or when you are not speaking, we ask that you please do mute your line to cut down on background sound. If anyone has any difficulties hearing today's conference, please press the star followed by the zero, and an operator will assist you. I would now like to turn the conference over to Mr. Richard Simon, Network Chair, Peace Action Network. Please go ahead.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. This is Dick Simon. I'm Chair of the Peace Action Network, or PAN, and a member of the WPO New England chapter. I want to lay out just a little bit before we begin the call here. First, thanking everyone for joining, and certainly thanking Cyrus for leading this. We're trying something today which is somewhat different than other past global conference calls the different networks have run, of making this substantially more intimate and conversational. So what we're going to do is have Cyrus give background for 20, 25 minutes. And then at that time, everyone is in a listen-only mode, or your phone is automatically muted. After that, everyone's line will be opened up, and people can just introduce themselves in their chapter, and then it'll become a real conversation. So Cyrus Razaghi is living in Tehran. He's been involved in the Iranian market for the last 10, 12 years, deals with the government, the private sector, and is very interested in Iranian politics. Cyrus also, very importantly, and with tremendous gratitude from myself and others who were able to join, organized the Peace Action Network member-owned experience in Iran earlier this year, in March, which was absolutely a fantastic 12 days in the country, where we met with everyone from Stock Exchange to the leading rock musician, who saw amazing things and learned a tremendous amount. So, Cyrus, let me turn this over to you, and please go ahead.
Thank you. Thank you, Dick, and thank you, everyone, for being on the call. I know it's too early for some of you dialing in from the west coast of Canada and U.S. I apologize for that, but I'm truly honored to be with you today. Let me also thank Richard Simon on Peace Action Network for organizing this call and contributing to what I believe is better understanding of Iran within YPO and outside of YPO. And this understanding, I believe, is very much needed these days. Iran has been, for the last three decades or so, on the news all the time, as far as long as we can all remember, and unfortunately mostly for the wrong reasons. With the exceptions of some film festivals or art exhibitions, the news we hear about Iran is always negative, making some people, especially in the West, basically simply hate the country. And in fact, it was only last week that Iran was voted again as the most sort of most hated country, and Germany the most sort of loved or best country. So I hope that this presentation and other activities that PAN is doing can give you a more balanced view of the country and can help us better understand Iran and Iranians, and for what I believe better days are still ahead of us in terms of Iran's better relations with the rest of the world and its contribution to the world's peace and economy. With that, I will be referring to some key points throughout the presentation, which I believe are the main takeaways from this call. Number one is that Iran is a regional power with strong economic fundamentals and massive potentials, and this is not necessarily a bad thing because it can be a great source of stability if the political standoff with the West is resolved and Iran can ease tensions with its neighbors. Number two is that Iran is overall, I argue, is a rational player compared to other so-called rogue nations such as North Korea or rogue ideologies and groups such as Al-Qaeda and Taliban. Number three is that Iran is at a crucial crossroads for facing serious and even existential internal and external threats and challenges. And I believe that, you know, a major change in the system is an inevitable eventuality. But I also believe that change must come from within. Iran is also again, has massive economic potential. But unless and until the people's aspirations for freedom and democracy are met, these potentials remain unlocked. And I'd like to also say that despite all these problems, I believe there is hope for Iran. I believe that with political, economic, social, scientific, artistic renaissance may be the case for Iran in not too far in the future. I give it 3 to 5 years. And finally, I'd like to also mention that I believe countries and companies alike should have a fluid and flexible strategy with regards to Iran. Now, hopefully some of you have received the summary slideshow that Tania has sent, and I'm using that as the basis of the presentation. But if you don't have it, if you have it, great, keep it open. If not, no worries. I won't be referring to any specific slides or charts. I also apologize for going too fast, as we want to dedicate, as Richard mentioned, more time to questions. Going to talk a little bit about Iranian people, geopolitics, some interesting contradictions within the Islamic Republic, cover key challenges of Iranian economy, including corruption, sanctions, inflation, unemployment, talk about the complexities of Iranian politics and focusing on the upcoming presidential elections and the nuclear crisis. And finally, a focus on key areas of Iran's foreign policies and their implications on Iran and the rest of the world. So with that, let me start with a very quick overview of Iran. Very old country. In fact, according to some sources, the oldest civilization, one of the first empire, and then conquered by Greeks, Mongols, Arabs. And being an Eastern competitor to Greek civilization and culture, Iran was demonized from ancient times. It's a large country, the second largest country in the Middle East in terms of GDP after Saudi Arabia, in terms of population after Egypt. It's in terms of most strategic parameters like size of the country, population, size of economies, Iran is among the top 20 in the world. It has a very diverse climate, four-season climate. The temperature difference at any point throughout the year between the hottest and the coldest parts of Iran could be anywhere between 30 to 55 Celsius. For your information, the hottest spot on Earth is in southern Iran. And in terms of ethnicity, about half of the population is Persian, about a quarter Azeri, Turkish Azeris. And the rest are split between Arabs, Kurdish, other minorities. Instead of religion, overwhelming majority Shia Muslim, about 9% Sunnis, and 1% Christian Jews and Zoroastrians. And again, interesting fact is that the largest Jewish population in the Middle East outside of Israel remains to be in Iran. Strategic importance, Iran is a very key location linking Caspian Sea to the Gulf, linking the Asia to Europe through Turkey, holding some of the largest energy reserves, oil and gas in the world, second overall, has close links and therefore influence over key countries like Iraq in terms of religion and Afghanistan in terms of language. And according to credible sources like Goldman Sachs, Iran will be among the top 15, 16 countries when it comes to economy down the road for decades to come, only a couple of spots behind Italy and Canada. In terms of Iran's links and in some cases influencing the region, can divide this into three categories. Religion, Iran shares the Shiite branch of Islam strongly with Lebanon, Iraq, and Bahrain, and mightily with Pakistan, Afghanistan, Syria, and other places like Saudi Arabia, where there is a minority Shiite Muslim population. In terms of language, Iran has close links with mainly Afghanistan and Tajikistan, and then to some lesser degree with some CIS countries and Pakistan. And ideologically, politically, Iran is aligned with countries like China, Russia, Cuba, Venezuela, etc. And this is interesting because, ironically, these are all secular states. The common denominator here is that they all want to resist what they call the West and U.S. dominance of the world affairs, but the fact that they are all totalitarian systems and regimes make them very, not very credible. Some interesting contradictions in Iran. Iran has been, you know, has had the highest growth rate for scientific and technology achievement in the world. Is one of the only 8 countries that has successfully cloned animals several times, has reached space, etc. And yet it's also the biggest exporter of brains in the world per capita, i.e. Iranian-educated people don't like to stay in Iran. Iran has the second largest energy reserves, as mentioned, but has one of the lowest GDP per capita in the region and some of the least developed industries in many sectors. In terms of female-to-male ratio, again, Iran is number one. At some point, there was more than 60% university students, female university students, and they had to introduce a quota. Women participate in commerce, in politics, in everyday life. But ironically, there are major restrictions on women, including a mandatory hijab. Iran is one of the only countries that enforce that. In other areas, again, Islamic banking. Theoretically, Iran is the largest Islamic banking market in the world. But it has also one of the most inefficient and corrupt banking systems in the world, with some multi-billion dollar in Bazopen scandals and very interesting cases. Finally, and very importantly, Iran is a very old country and has contributed a lot to the world civilization. But today there are major crises going on with regards to culture and society. And I would like to argue that this is where the biggest damage has been done by the Islamic Republic and is the hardest to reverse. Years of brainwashing in schools, you know, people having to live a double life outside and inside their homes has severely damaged the culture of Iran, and this will unfortunately take several generations to undo. Quickly, some economic facts and indicators. Iran, luckily, has always been a free market economy. Government involvement has increasingly been the case in Iran. In fact, 65 to 70% of the economy is controlled directly or indirectly by the government, and thus the massive corruption issue we are facing today. GDP per capita much lower than the rest of the region, certainly compared to other oil-rich and energy-rich countries. Some, you know, Iran is developing some sectors in the sense that the entire supply chain exists locally and is severely underdeveloped in some other sectors and industries. And despite development of foreign trade, Iran is not integrated into the world's economy because of the sanctions. Iran's trade partners, UAE is the largest exporter to Iran, thanks to re-export of Western goods into Iran, followed by China, EU, and Turkey. And Iran's largest export non-oil export destinations, interestingly today, are Iraq and China, followed by other countries including UAE and India. Turkey and China have also been the largest foreign investors in Iran. One of the key challenges of the economy today is the foreign currency crisis, and therefore the massive inflation we are facing. Compared to 2 years ago, U.S. dollar is more than 3.5 times more expensive today, and thus the extraordinary inflationary wave that has hit the country. So prices of ordinary goods are anywhere from 2.5 to 4 times more expensive today compared to 2 years ago. And this is not obviously sustainable and is increasingly leading to dissatisfaction among the ordinary people in Iran. In terms of corruption, unfortunately, Iran has become one of the most corrupt countries in the world, reflected in the Corruption Index, published every year, where Iran is in the same league as Azerbaijan and Russia, and I argue probably even worse. Most prominent so-called private sector businessmen are really fronts for powerful ayatollahs and generals to launder money, and there's a whole bunch of unethical business tactics and practices that are going on and have become the norm. And this is why I also mentioned that, you know, the damage to the culture, including business culture, trade culture, has been more than any other area. In terms of sanctions, Iran has experienced some of the most severe sanctions ever implemented, even more than, say, Cuba and the former Soviet bloc. Sanctions have impacted all sectors, and in some cases, unfortunately, like aviation, medical equipment, and medicine, they have been quite unfair to the innocent civilians and ordinary people. And this is the problem with sanctions, that no matter how targeted, they still hurt and can seriously alienate people, especially young people. In terms of human capital challenges, this is another major challenge for the government, but also an opportunity for the country. We have this massive talent pool of young graduates, very talented, who are unfortunately mostly unemployed or unhappy with their jobs, wanting to leave the country. So unemployment is quite acute when it comes to the more educated segments of the society. And then on the other hand, you have this massive potential of the expats, who represent not only massive investment opportunities for the country, but more importantly, could be instrumental in changing and modernizing Iran. Estimated, 3 to 5 million Iranians living outside, with a net value of somewhere between $1 to $1.5 trillion. In terms of foreign companies active in Iran, despite the sanctions, all kinds of companies, including U.S. companies, can do and have been doing business in Iran in industries from food and beverage to pharmaceutical education. And we just heard yesterday that with the potential waiving of sanctions on consumer communication hardware and software, new areas may be opening, including IT, aviation, while other, sanctions are getting tougher on some other sectors, such as banking. I have personally, had the chance to work with some of these large, international brands, including some of the top American brands that we all know. Moving on to Iran's complex political system. Now, whereas Iran used to be seen as a semi-democratic theocracy, today it's more and more a semi-military dictatorship, where the supreme leader has the ultimate power in key areas such as military, intelligence, foreign policy, and veto power, strong veto power in other areas. There are still elements of democracy in the system, in the fact that people can vote, in the fact that the supreme leader is, theoretically, indirectly elected by the people. So some people compare it to other monarchies in the region. But in reality, and especially in the last few years, and considering the major setbacks on the way of reforms, Iran today is no more democratic than most other regimes in the region. So basically, you have a supreme leader who acts as the ultimate decision maker, and then he has a whole bunch of other people, including the president, the head of armed forces, the head of Ministry of Intelligence, who act merely as his advisors. But he's definitely has the top post and has the ultimate decision-making power in all most important areas. With regards to political factions, there are four major factions: ideologists or pure principalists. They believe in core Islamic values of the revolution. They believe in very slow and controlled sort of economic opening, far slower than China. They can definitely mobilize at least 15% of the people, voters, but their supporters always vote. Nationalist conservatives, led by the current president, Ahmadinejad, they are more leftist in terms of, social justice, but more pragmatic in terms of economic development. They have, higher voter support in rural areas of Iran, but they have now been completely marginalized since the disqualification of Ahmadinejad's favorite candidate, Mr. Mashari. And then you have the pragmatists and reformists, who are also marginalized these days, and despite their differences, are more and more supporting each other and perhaps merging. They believe in better relations with the West. They believe in economic development, faster development, economic development. And by far, they have the highest support among urban voters, and especially in big cities. In terms of the presidential elections, although on the surface all factions have a presence in the race, key figures from all factions except for the leaders' camp have been eliminated by the means of disqualification by the Guardian Council, which is the elections vetting body. And thus the leader's choice has more chance to win. And I would argue that also this is not such a bad thing, since, having a single united front who is authorized and willing to negotiate with the West may not be such a bad outcome at the end. It's remained to be seen, of course. With regards to the nuclear crisis, obviously there are three scenarios. One, the worst-case scenario is that negotiations fall, completely fail, and no deal is on the horizon. I give this one a small chance of only 20%, simply because Iran doesn't want to be seen as pulling out of the negotiations and giving the West and Israel an excuse to attack. Scenario two is the status quo, when negotiations drag on forever without any specific results. And then scenario three, which is best case and hopefully has more chance after the elections, is that negotiations succeed and a deal is reached. I'm sure there are going to be questions about this later, so I leave it for the question period. Finally, with regards to Iran's foreign policy, which is also one of the most confusing and mismanaged areas of Iran's politics, I'd like to start with a quick comparison between Iran and North Korea, referring to my earlier comment that Iran is overall a rational player. And the reason I say this is that, you know, in terms of threatening to invade other countries, and Korea, North Korea has done this several times. Iran has not invaded any country for centuries and has not even threatened to invade other countries. Iran has not tested any weapons of mass destruction and has never used, even when it was almost justified because Saddam Hussein used chemical weapons against Iran, Iran never used any such weapons. North Korea has tested, you know, such weapons, as we know, ignores international treaties and basically doesn't observe NPT. Iran respects most international treaties and observes NPT. And despite, you know, the Iranian leaders consolidating power in Iran, there are still many more checks and balances compared to North Korea, and a higher degree of freedom for the media in Iran to make sure that the leader doesn't become an absolute dictator who can, you know, take a radical action and jeopardize the whole system or the country. In terms of Iran-U.S. relations, you know, there are major sources of mistrust, historical sources of mistrust, as we all know. Hostages, you know, for U.S. Hostages is number one. U.S. never managed to get over this issue, and it never, you know, trust Iran because of the events of early days of the revolution. On the other side, Iran has never managed to get over the U.S.-backed coup d'etat in the 1950s, which many believe delayed by decades the prospect of democracy in Iran. And in fact, many believe it was those events that radicalized the leftist movements and the clergy and united them to finally bring down the Shah's regime back in 1979. Now, more recently, the main source of mistrust on the Iranian side has been that, you know, despite Iran supporting U.S.'s effort after 9/11 against the Taliban, Iran was immediately labeled by President Bush as part of the infamous Axis of Evil, and the regime change policy came to play, and that forever alienated Iran's top leadership from trusting the U.S. again. Now, today, the situation is that U.S. and Iran need each other in Afghanistan, in Iraq, and also because of the economic pressure on Iran, more and more Iran has to negotiate and has no choice. So there are increasing sort of chance for negotiation after the presidential elections. In terms of Iran-Israel relations, no historical issues until before the revolution. They are today convenient enemies, I would say. They both use each other for domestic and, you know, consumption and international legitimacy. The hardline is our both sides actually love and need each other, I would say. Despite Iran's harsh rhetoric, it has no intentions and means to attack Israel. And Israel attacking Iran will only strengthen the Islamic Republic. Realistically, for as long as the Islamic Republic is in power, there is no chance for any dialogue. But that doesn't necessarily have to mean a conflict, and conflict is definitely avoidable. Finally, in terms of Iran-Syria relations, they have been allies since the revolution. They have a partnership to support anti-Israeli movements like Hamas to Hezbollah. And the current civil war has negatively impacted Iran's relation with its strategic neighbor, Turkey. Now, the fall of the Syrian regime can have massive implications for Iran. Obvious one is losing, you know, the most important proxy and ally in the region, and thus the shift in strategic balance against Iran. Number two, which is not so obvious, but I believe is more important, is that the fall of the Syrian regime will show the Iranian people that no regime is invincible, and that despite the loss of life, change is definitely possible through persistence. Nevertheless, Iran's role stabilizing the Syrian situation shouldn't be ignored. Iran can indeed play a constructive role in Syria. Now, with that, I'd like to have a few questions, actually, quickly to finish off. So what is Iran pursuing in its foreign policy? I would say 10% the ideology, 90% survival. What is Iran pursuing in its nuclear policy is the capability that they want, not necessarily the weapons. And they want immunity from outside attacks. And they use the North Korean example that, look, if somebody has nuclear weapons, they never dare to attack them. Whereas others like Iraq, like Libya, like other countries, they are not immune to these kinds of outside threats and attacks. How has the system managed to survive for so long? My answer is that simply lack of any organized, solid opposition and or any charismatic leader that could unite people and at least push for reforms, if not the radical change in the system. And when can we expect significant change in Iran? In my opinion, and in the absence of any unexpected events and developments, I would give it another 3 to 5 years. With that, ladies and gentlemen, as famously they say, you know, face your fear. If you're interested in Iran, if you're curious, if you're worried, if you hate Iran, face your fear, come to Iran. Richard organized a very interesting delegation a few months ago. We would love to have you soon in Iran. With that, I'd like to thank you for your attention. My apologies if I went too fast, and let me turn it over to our host for opening up to questions.
Great. Thank you very much. And along with Cyrus's comment of face your fears or you know, get to see you know, for yourself and form a more complete opinion, the Peace Action Network is having another member-owned experience next April, and there will be information going out about that. So it's an amazing, amazing opportunity. So what we're going to try to do now, and I'm using terms like try to, just we'll have to see how it works, is unmuting all of the lines, going around and having those who are on the call just giving your name and chapter so that people have some sense as to who some of the participants are, and then opening for questions. So, operator, can you unmute the lines, and then we can go around and have people just give their name and chapter.
Absolutely.
And again, if there's too much background noise, we may have to remute and figure out the more traditional system.
Hi, this is Larry Gross from Los Angeles.
Hello.
Hi. Hi, I'm one of the early risers. Thank you for that summary. And I just wanted to ask about the Green Revolution.
Larry, could I interrupt just for a second? The intent is, and you'll get the first question then, but if we can go around to just everyone on the call, just give name and chapter, and then Larry, what?
Oh, okay. Sorry. Hi, Larry Kagan, San Francisco, WPO.
Hi, John. Sorry. Cyrus Segari, YPO Bel Air.
Hi, John de Blasio, Chicago, Windy City.
Good morning. Good morning. Go ahead, please.
Good morning. Philip Scholl, YPO Metro, New York.
Robert Zarnigan, YPO Los Angeles.
Charles Segali, WPO DC.
Daniel Koppler, YPO Metro. Hey, Philip.
Good morning.
Adrian Pouliot, WPO Quebec.
Hi everybody. I'm Priyanka Mittal from YPO from South Asia region.
Hi, Faraday Gesswine from Yankee Chapter.
Right. Is there anyone else who would like to introduce themselves, or?
Hi, it's Lisa.
All right, great. Larry, as I said, why don't you do
Go ahead, Larry.
Thanks for that great summary. I wish I could have got on the trip. Maybe I can go on the next one. I wanted to ask about the Green Revolution in June of 2009 and what happened there and where people were getting killed in the streets, sort of similar to what's going on now in Syria, obviously on a smaller scale. But could you talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely. Thank you for the question. Yeah, the Green Movement, unfortunately, has been subsided. The leaders are basically under house arrest. Nobody has heard or seen them for last few years. And people under tremendous economic pressure have basically not forgotten, but for the time being have put that issue aside, seeing what that can happen in places like Syria with the major bloodshed that we have. We have a saying in Persian that, you know, this is fire under the ashes, and one mistake by the system, by the regime, or one event can easily spark this revolution. The problem was that people's aspirations, people went for green movement thinking that it can seriously challenge the system and bring about a major change. But the leaders of the green movements are part of the system. They were not against, you know, completely changing the system. So different people, you know, supported that movement for different reasons, and they are now all over, you know, the place, and they are not in the political scene. But I believe this will reemerge at some point. And again, it needs to have, you know, we need to have some kind of a dramatic event or something that spark that we can revitalize that movement. But, you know, based on even, you know, the government's statistics, some 70% or so people were supporting this movement at some point.
Cyrus?
Yeah.
Hi, Robert Zarn again, YPLA. How are you?
Hi, Robert. How are you?
Good. Thanks very much. Thank you so much for doing this and also taking the time to go over the information.
Pleasure.
Appreciate it. My question is, as you know, the U.S. has put on some pretty heavy sanctions on Iran, and I understand that Canada just recently imposed some comprehensive sanctions against Iran. And I'm just wondering, these latest sanctions that have been passed by the U.S. and Canada, how does that impact, let's say, either your or your clients' businesses, and how has that made it? Has that made it tough for you and your clients? What is the?
Thank you for the question, Robert. Let me say something. Actually, it looks to me, based on yesterday's announcement, that the U.S. will soon ease sanctions on consumer communication hardware and software that includes laptops, mobile devices, and other computer devices, etc. It's very interesting and is a change, is a fresh approach, because sanctions before were across the board for any company, anyone who does business in Iran, except for those who get an OFAC license. This, to me, makes sort of more sense that they will allow, hopefully, medicine and pharmaceutical products and medical equipment, other essential non-military products, food and beverage and things like that, to be traded with Iran, but then probably impose more sanctions or tighten sanctions in other areas, again, like oil and gas and banking. With regards to our clients, I mean, I have, you know, American clients in food that managed to obtain a legal OFAC license, basically, which is an exemption, so they can legally trade with Iran, let's say, for grains, wheat, barley, corn, et cetera, and legally receive money through designated banking channels. This is the case of Cargill or some large, you know, agricultural companies from the U.S. Others have found interesting and complex basically setups when they use their countries like UAE, or they handle this to other channels. So it's interesting. I give you an example. I mean, this announcement yesterday hopefully will pave the way for companies like Apple to do business. There are more than 6 million iPhone users in Iran. This is a massive customer base for a company like Apple. So these kind of targeted sanctions can help some companies, perhaps like Apple, may hurt some other companies in other areas, that are under sanctions. For us, the nature of clients are changing. You know, we have maybe less clients down the road from U.S. and more from Europe or Asia. But the big names have always been there: Coca-Cola, Procter & Gamble, pharmaceutical giants, because they have an OFAC license and they can do legally trade with Iran regardless of the sanctions.
Okay. But it is, do you think that the sanctions have been hurtful? How do people perceive it in Iran?
Absolutely. In some cases, and I give you aviation, Iran cannot buy aircrafts, even civilian aircrafts, passenger planes, which is ridiculous. And so the sanctions have been blind in the past and have hurt people. So many aviation accidents that we had, people blame it on these blind sanctions. Hopefully, down the road, again, even in the absence of serious negotiation and opening and reaching a deal, hopefully the sanctions, the nature of sanctions will be changed to sort of smarter, more targeted sanctions that can prevent dual use or military sort of trade with Iran, but can allow, other areas of trade with Iran, like food and beverage and pharmaceutical. So everyday people in Iran have been hurt by the sanctions, from aviation to all kinds of other things, but that has become a fact of life. And, thanks to other places that have been, trade hubs for Iran, those essential goods have been reaching Iran, i.e. pharmaceutical products to Dubai, to Turkey, to other third countries. But definitely it has hurt and impacted a lot of people.
Thank you.
No problem. Thank you.
Cyrus, this is happens to be Cyrus as well from the YPO Bel Air. Thank you.
Oh,
again.
Great. thanks for being involved.
Yeah, well, thank you so much. This is very enlightening, and it's great to see a discussion happening about something that, frankly, in the business world is almost looked at as taboo, and with being Iran in general. A couple of questions for you. I'll start off with, you talked about the upcoming presidential election, and you mentioned specifically Mohammad Ghalibaf, who we've recognized. I'm an Iranian citizen as well as a U.S. citizen with family still living in Iran, and I travel there frequently.
Okay.
And he's been, from what I've seen, to be relatively a progressive leader. And for those of you in the call not familiar with the gentleman I'm speaking with, he's the current mayor of Iran. And has, from my perspective, seemed to done a lot to help the city. It's mayor of Tehran, not the mayor of Iran. What are your thoughts about him if he is elected? Will there be any real change, do you expect, or is it more of the same with the supreme leader driving the course forward?
Yeah, I think somebody like Ghalibaf would be able to seriously negotiate with the West because he's conservative, he's in the leaders camp, but he has the military discipline. He does projects. He's done a lot for Tehran. People like him. He's charismatic. He's quite a charismatic personality. But more importantly, as I mentioned before, is that because that sort of united front, the leaders' camp, seem to have authorization to talk to the U.S. And people see, any other option, including even a reformist coming to power. And again, just like Khatami being blocked for 4 years, what's the point of having a president which cannot accomplish any sort of major sort of policy change or opening, negotiations with the West, etc. So Ghalibaf, in the eyes of many Iranians, is quite an interesting character because he has done a lot of good for the city of Tehran. He has discipline. He has charisma. Although people around him are somehow corrupt, some of them, but corruption has not been a major sort of sticking point on his sort of record. So I personally believe that from the leaders, the principalist or conservative camp, if there's anyone that can do a good job as a president, both in terms of economic development and also opening relations with the West, I think that's probably Olivov. And many people believe that either Velayati will, pull out of the race in favor of him, or him pulling out in favor of Velayati, and one becomes the vice president, the other the president. But again, in Iran's politics, there are so many unexpected things that nobody knows. But more and more, it seems to everyone that it's going to be either Ghalibaf or Jalili, the current sort of head of national security and the chief negotiator with the group of 5+1.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Can I ask why you projected that real change would occur in 3 to 5 years? And then also, could I ask a question about the Basij militia and the way that the Iranian military complex controls and works in the private sector? I'd just like some commentary from your perspective on that. So the two questions are, why do you think real change is going to occur in 3 to 5 years? And secondly, can you comment on the role of the Basij and of the Iranian military in the private sector?
Right. Okay. Well, thanks for the questions. With regards to the change coming in 3 to 5 years, in my opinion, is that, the current situation is not sustainable. Economically, the country has another 2 to 3 years maximum. If the sanctions sort of tighten even further, the current situation is not sustainable indefinitely. So the economy, if things don't improve, will collapse within 2 to 3 years. More and more people under pressure, and they're going to be very voiceful about their dissatisfaction with the status quo. And also, even if somebody who could potentially spark a change, like Olivov, comes to presidency and takes control of at least the executive branch of Iran's political system, it will take for them at least another 2-3 years. It cannot do anything immediate. So it's not like the U.S. when you say, a president can shoot, implement change within the first 100 days or show the major direction. So things will change. But in my opinion, economically, things are not sustainable beyond 2 to 3 years. And also socially, the situation is very explosive. I often, compare Iran with the Middle Ages in Europe, when people, the church views, God and religion to control, everyday life of people. And that went on for hundreds of years. Now, today, thanks to technology and mobile and internet and all these technologies, it cannot go on indefinitely. And I also believe that, the outside forces with regards to the nuclear crisis, if it doesn't reach some kind of a deal or compromise, if Iran doesn't accommodate such a deal, there could be a potential conflict. But that, again, I give that another at least 2 or 3 years. So it's not going to be this year or next year, as many analysts believe. With regards to your second question, Revolutionary Guards and Basij militia, obviously, they are basically a military. Basij is the underground military apparatus of the Revolutionary Guards. Very suppressive. But these guys, both Revolutionary Guards and the Basij militia, have very vast business and financial portfolio. So, and that's why I say today, 10% about ideology, 90% about survival. And, these guys want to stay in power. They love the power and the financial power that they have. And that's why they are also so much against talking to the U.S., because they have monopolized the economy to a point that they don't want any opening with the West. They have massive interest in keeping the country closed. And Basij militia is no exception. They are also in nature, very brutal, very violent, but also they hold vast financial and business interests in the country. And so this is another aspect of the system where you have the militia, who is supposed to be theoretically, ideologically driven, but they are after the financial interest, and they don't hesitate to use violence against the people in order to keep that financial interest and power. I'm sorry, I'm not sure if I answered your second question. Was your second question answered or not?
No, clearly. I mean, that they're deeply involved in society and in the private sector, and they have vested interest in seeing and not seeing the change that you're talking about continue, and that sanctions contribute to their power base, because it basically takes the economy underground. So it was just, you validated a lot of thoughts that I had. That's all. Thanks.
Yeah. Absolutely. All major projects in Iran are in the hands of the Revolutionary Guards or the Basij Militia. So these guys are now monopolizing all the major sort of industries and large strategic projects. And so they also they have the guns and they have the military power, and they use that to protect their financial interests in the country.
So this is Philip. So you have a closed industry and closed government, pretty much corrupt and controlled by few. You have a large population of good, decent people. What are the options? You know, we haven't seen any change other than more negativity over the past 30 years. What is going to be besides sanctions, which they have been effective? And, you know the old story, you put someone into a hole, eventually they'll crawl their way out of it, climbing on others to get out. So what are the options in, effectively creating a different mindset?
Yeah. Again, then that's why I said the change should come from within, not from outside. The sanctions from the outside have been quite effective. Putting pressure on the Iranian regime. But any political change will and should come from within. And for that, I mean, don't forget that, before the Arab Spring, it was Iranians who were on the streets demonstrating against the system. They were suppressed for the time being. But that's, again, as I said, is fire under the ashes. And I believe at some point the system can, internally Iran will face major challenges. The situation can be extremely explosive. Now, the sanctions have done a lot in terms of, increasing people's demand from the system, that why our lives and situation is getting, worse and worse. We have witnessed even Bazaaris, the traditional merchants of Bazaar, who have always been, pro regime, demonstrating against it. So a combination of these outside, pressures and, the demands of people, especially the young people, I believe personally, unless these guys wise up and again go back on the reforms path, at some point becomes explosive. Now, everybody's hope is that, after the elections, and it seems to me, I get reports and news that, the Supreme Leader has authorized this new team of Velayati and Ghalibov to reach a deal, to negotiate this time in good faith to reach a deal. So the hope is that the transition will be smooth and without too much violence, i.e. after the elections, these guys seriously talk to the U.S. and the West and defuse that situation and slowly improve the economy and open it up. But frankly speaking, I mean, we have seen so many setbacks, and we have seen that, unfortunately, in some aspects, the system is not capable of reforming itself, and therefore, we may reach a situation that, especially again, if a country like a regime like Syria falls and shows to the Iranians that everything is possible if you persist long enough, you can achieve any change, fundamental change, we may have actually another revolution at our hands. So, and that's again, but I mean, so there are different possibilities. The Islamic Republic has shown time and time again that you're capable of defusing these domestic and international sort of crises and manage to survive. But I think that's not, you know, indefinite. This situation cannot be sustainable, mainly because of the internal issues, economy, unemployment, dissatisfaction, and, you know, special events may spark again a revolution. Who knows? I don't know. I mean, nobody knows.
Hi, Yariv from Israel. Can you hear me?
Yes.
I have a question on follow-up on the Syria comment. Is it seen internally as a regime change or as a Shia-Sunni conflict in a different territory? Considered internally.
Right, right. Well, as you know, Syria is not a completely like Shiite, just like Iran. It doesn't have the same, doesn't share the same exact branch of Islam. They have Alawites, which are close, more close sort of to Shiites than Sunnis. They are a minority. So from, you know, what Iranians hear on TV and on radio is that, you know, outside forces are pushing for yet another revolution in the region. And of course, a lot of people disagree with Iran's support of the Syrian regime. They don't believe that economically they should help, and also militarily they should help the Syrian regime. So a lot of hello.
Keep going.
Hello. Oh, sorry. I thought I lost you guys for a second.
Now you
So to answer your question, from, you know, what Iranians hear on the media, that this is a game, a political game, to change the strategic balance of the region. They don't see it as a Sunni versus Shia sort of rivalry and sectarian violence. It may have been in that direction lately, but it didn't start because of that. So, but again, a lot of people in Iran believe that, you know, the everyday Iranian is under so much pressure. Why are we sending money and weapons and our resources to sustain another regime? But of course, the media is portraying a completely different picture. And what Iranians are seeing is that, oh yeah, these are U.S.-supported Zionist sort of elements trying to change and bring down an anti-Israeli sort of regime in the region. One of the last bastions of resistance against Israel and all that. But again, I don't hear and see too much sort of Shiite versus Sunni argument in that. It's more political, regional sort of geopolitics rather than Shiite versus Sunni.
Okay, thank you.
No problem, thank you.
Where does Russia play in all this as far as their support for Iran, as comparison to their support for Syria? I mean, with the slide about change within 3 to 5 years, do you see Russia allowing that to happen, or is the cozy relationship between Iran and Russia one such that they will maintain a closed government and close control?
Russia, of course, in the absence of popular uprising and in case of any foreign intervention, Russia will definitely, you know, try to defend another ally of his in the region. So, but again, in the case of a domestic uprising against the system, I don't think there is anything Russia can do. So in the past, for example, during the Green Movement thing, and whenever needed, Iran has benefited from Hezbollah sort of military personnel, even physically coming to Tehran to suppress, you know, demonstrators. Russia has not done that and will not do that. So, but Russia will definitely resist any change from outside of Iran, i.e., if there is a military threat against Iran. But again, you have to, I mean, you know better than I do that Russia and China both have so much vested interest in their relations with the U.S. that at least for China, definitely China will not intervene if Iran is attacked militarily. Russia, I'm not sure. Russia shares sort of sea borders with Iran, sees Iran as a very, very strategic neighbor with access to the Gulf and all that. So in case of an outside sort of intervention, many believe that Russia will act to save the Islamic regime. But if there is a domestic sort of uprising and a change within, I don't think Russia will and can do anything about that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Cyrus, in the last couple of minutes, do you have any comments you'd like to make in wrapping up? And I thank you. But before you wrap up, let me just mention a couple of things to callers. First, if you have not yet signed up for to be a member of the Peace Action Network or PAN, it's really easy to do on the YPO website, and you can be kept informed of calls and travel-related experiences. We have an upcoming member-owned travel experience to North Korea, a return to North Korea, and that's in October. And then, as we've been speaking about earlier, to Iran in next April and several others on the drawing board. And we're also looking toward a model of having a monthly global conference call. So people who have interest in a particular topic or suggestions, you know, please let us know through that. And then before Cyrus wraps up, I just wanted, on behalf of all of us on the call, to thank you so much for doing this. I mean, time and effort into organizing.
Oh, it's been a great pleasure. I mean, that's why, you know, I've been a YPOer only for 2 years, but I absolutely admire the spirit. I mean, I see so many Americans on this call, and even, you know, despite, you know, the 30-plus years of animosity and hostility, and that's very encouraging. I mean, I hope I didn't portray a completely negative picture. I mean, what I wanted to say is that Iran has a great history, has fundamentally sort of great potentials, but change is in the air. You can feel it. When people come to Iran, you talk to taxi drivers, you talk to ordinary people, you see that people are changing, and I think that's a fundamental thing that and benefit, a byproduct of the revolution. That, you know, people are automatically separating religion from politics. And I would definitely love to have you all in Iran at some point. Thank you, Richard, for organizing this call, for allowing me to be on this call. And it's been a great pleasure talking to you guys. Thank you so much for being on the call.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. All right, and guys, by all means, email me. I just created a network called Doing Business in Iran. It doesn't have to do really much with business. It's about, you know, if people are interested in current events and affairs and follow these, I will put more information there. So you can definitely email me or contact me via that network. Thank you so much.
And thank you.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, this will conclude the conference call for today. We thank you for your participation, and you may now disconnect your lines.